Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. This is podcast number 65. I'm George Taylor. Today, we're thinking of clerical crime. So what I want to do is revisit one of my favorite books, Nonprofit Murders. It's a clerical crime mystery written by my friend Becky Woolley, and I'll leave you with some thoughts after we listen to some excerpts to ponder as we close out our podcast today. Clerical crime is a special genre of mystery in which this book falls. Becky explained the genre last year when I interviewed her. So what spiritual ideas were you wanting to communicate in this book? What are you trying to get across to your audience?
I honestly, when I started writing, had no notion of putting spiritual ideas in the book. Apparently, what I am comes out of what I write, and I'm definitely a spiritual person. And I found out after the book was written that I had written in the genre that's called clerical crime.
Clerical crime. Okay.
Clerical crime is any sort of a mystery novel which the solution is found by someone who's involved in a religious body. There are Catholic clerical crimes. There are Jewish clerical crimes. There are Episcopal clerical crimes. Mm-hmm. There's all different religions that are represented in this genre. And I have read the genre extensively, not knowing that's what I was doing. But the main point of any clerical crime is that the author is talking about religion. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about what's right about it, what's wrong about it. And I find the subject fascinating, and apparently that's why I wrote about it.
Okay.
You can have whole sections where the characters are talking about what they believe. And that naturally produces information about their spirituality.
Right.
I particularly wanted to get across, once I found out that's what I was writing about, what I really wanted to get across was the idea that Christianity is not a set of rules. Christianity is faith in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And following Christ. And it's freeing. It's not hemming in. It is absolutely freeing.
Right. Any other messages you want the reader to take away from your book?
I want them to enjoy the book. I want them to think about what they believe. That is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people that are close to me who have come out of a very legalistic religion, and they love my books because they can laugh all the way through what they've experienced,
mm-hmm.
what they have come out of, and they can see, yes, this is ludicrous. Yes, this is something that needs to be pointed out, even among Christians.
Mm-hmm.
We as Christians need to be able to say, look, the world is pointing fingers at us and laughing. Let's figure out whether or not they're laughing legitimately. You know, they're maybe some things that we are doing or thinking or believing that are absolutely ludicrous. And yes, we need to self-examine, and yes, we need to laugh at ourselves.
Becky's book looks at things about churches which can be ludicrous and cause the world to laugh at the Bride of Christ. Let me share some excerpts with you where we meet the ministers who are murdered and the one who is threatened with murder in her book. In this first segment, we're going to meet the Reverend Bishop, Reverend Bishop. Now, he gets his double name since his last name is Bishop, and then his mother named him Reverend, and then he is appointed a reverend and a bishop. So he is Reverend Bishop, Reverend Bishop. After his graduation, Bishop made it known that he intended to major in Bible, but his secret ambitions remained political. The pulpit would be his access. To test his own mettle and the local political climate, Bishop applied to New Jerusalem College. He was predictably rejected, but he left that fight for another day and accepted a scholarship to the Methodist Baptist Episcopal Holiness Alpha and Omega International Bible College, located in Mississippi. Bishop studied Bible reluctantly. he studied people relentlessly. By his sophomore year, he had gained renown throughout the South as a persuasive speaker. With his degree in Bible came his ordination in the MBEH Alpha and Omega International Tabernacle denomination. The now Reverend Bishop returned to Bennettville and began a series of revivals in the Bennettville High Gym, where the city had watched his previous triumphs. His sermons, a mixture of traditional gospel and political rhetoric, instilled both spiritual fervor and worldly acumen in ever-growing crowds. The attendees reached critical mass at about 200. With that number, the Reverend Bishop founded Greater Bennettville First MBEH Alpha and Omega International Tabernacle in a rented hall and started a building fund. That summer, the congregation broke ground and began building the permanent tabernacle. That oxymoron was completed a year later. The Rev hired a tailor, appointed himself bishop, and left his nickname behind. The furnace of ambition grew white hot, and the Reverend Bishop, began to forge alliances and hammer out political deals. He unashamedly wrapped his gospel message around two causes, minority rights and legalized gambling, somehow managing to convince his hearers that either goal could answer the question, what would Jesus do? His congregation swelled to 800 plus. Bishop culled the most zealous, a small squadron of self-important men, and a larger regiment of lonely women. He appointed six of the squadron members to the office of elder and the remainder to the office of deacon. The regiment of ladies became handmaidens of the Lord, anointed to serve Greater Bennettville First MBEH Alpha and Omega International Tabernacle's most urgent spiritual needs, as determined by the Reverend Bishop, With this army, Bishop organized the various minorities of Bennettville into the Rainbow Unity Party and convinced them that a gambling casino in Bennettville would end unemployment and save souls. Never mind that gambling was illegal in the state, laws could and should be changed. By the early 80s, without holding public office, Reverend Bishop represented a constituency of thousands. He was revered by the entire Methodist Baptist Episcopalian Holiness denomination, guarded by a squadron of elders and deacons, worshipped by a regiment of handmaidens, and protected by an as-yet untarnished reputation. He was ready to call in favors. In our second segment, we'll meet Miss Dinah and her husband, Brother Thomas Willis, the minister of the one true church. Miss Dinah was a bit disheveled, but right on time for ladies' Bible class, even though, to quote the Bible, her ox was in the ditch, meaning she had an urgent need that might justify her absence. She was expecting Amy Grace and Grit for Sunday dinner and had been cooking until early that morning. If she had been late, both Brother Willis and the ladies in the class would have disapproved, even though Dinah had more than she could do in one Sunday, serving dinner, chatting, cleaning up, visiting the sick with Thomas, and returning to church for evening worship. She would be lucky to be home by 9 that night. Her mind wandered. It was not as if she needed to be there. She had attended ladies' Bible class lessons on child-rearing and husband-pleasing at least weekly since Grace was a baby, 22 years and 8 congregations ago. How those lessons could be relevant to the majority of the women in attendance, elderly widows, she did not know. She also resented the fact that lessons for men on fatherhood and husbandry were never deemed necessary. With a few such lessons, Thomas Willis might not have dragged her and Grace from church to church like presumably indestructible Samsonite. She took a seat near the door, ready to leave as soon as the bell rang. She hated idle chit-chat, and ladies' classes were not the place to speak frankly. In ladies' class, you and your husband were not near divorce. In ladies' class, you did not hate your daughter's boyfriend. Nor did a woman question one true church leader's. If she complained, she was insulting the bride of Christ. If she questioned inequalities, she was usurping authority. If she expressed frustration with a cold or inattentive husband, she was not in proper submission. One true church policies had also caused the Willises financial problems. One true church ministers, and by default their wives, were employed at the discretion of independent, autonomous congregations, each having its own criteria for assessing a candidate. Few provided insurance or retirement funds. Once hired, a minister could be fired for any number of reasons, or none at all. The Willis family had moved 15 times and gone through 2 bankruptcies. Grace had attended 6 different schools. Thomas had no retirement savings, and his life insurance would barely cover a funeral. But his removal from 12 different pulpits was mostly his own doing. In each, he had preached a strict, legalistic interpretation of the Bible, leaving no means of entry for the Holy Spirit or grace. Where the Bible spoke, he spoke, and where the Bible was silent, he shouted. To his way of thinking, anyone who disagreed was in danger of hell fire. When feasible, he debated. When possible, he coerced. Inevitably, each of his congregations shrank to those true believers who agreed with his particular interpretation of the Bible. When the members became too few to afford a full-time preacher, the Willises moved on. For Dinah and Grace, each move was wrenching. But to Brother Willis, each firing was a victory for the Lord. He had done God's work, revealed hidden heresies, saved the souls of those who recanted. He formed no lasting friendships, called no earthly place home. After 11 forced moves, Dinah Lee adopted her husband's habit of keeping one's distance, but for her own reasons, and she acquired an odd assortment of minor disabilities, one of which was the inability to remember names. Among the 200 or so members of the Bennettville One True Church, she had no friends. Grace, to the contrary, became garrulous and adaptable. Dinah failed to comprehend her daughter's rare gift of loving well and constantly. And now we meet Pastor Newell Post Lawson. 4 decades ago, at 29, Newell Post Lawson was the youngest minister and the only Zionist Christian minister pastoring a church in Bennettville. Every Sunday, his fiery rhetoric, slathered with buttery intonation, alternately singed and soothed the rapt attendees at his many revivals. Hundreds slid down the aisle at every altar call. His holy city Zionist Christian Church grew from a few dozen members to over 600 in 3 scant years. Pastor Lawson rode the crest of the baby boom and kept his eye on the accompanying Christian youth movement. With the help and blessing of prominent Zionist Christians throughout the state, Lawson formed New Jerusalem College as a youth outreach of Holy City. New Jerusalem's statement of purpose was a lengthy harangue denouncing secular education, punctuated with reminders that young Christians needed to find mates among their kind, an oblique acknowledgement that NJC was, first and foremost, segregated. Segregated from all but white, conservative, Zionist Christians, and consequently an insular, non-challenging, suitable institution of higher education. As other Christian colleges adopted more lenient dress codes, denounced chauvinistic academic practices, and accepted benign cultural changes, NJC remained an island, both figuratively and literally, of mid-20th century mores and behaviors. Initially surrounded by the upscale homes and gardens of Bennettville's finest, the campus was now bordered by an iffy lot of inner-city poor, hopeful do-it-yourselfers, and greedy real estate speculators. When white flight hit Bennettville in the late 70s, the tender Caucasian neighbors were routed like Southern belles in front of a Yankee assault. And New Jerusalem was slipping from an all-time high enrollment of over 3,000 in 1975 to the current low of 900, slipping from its fingernail hold on 50-year-old sensibilities, and slipping from the all-powerful hands of Newell Post Lawson. Lawson's hold on NJC was being challenged from many quarters, the most recent, the three communication teachers now picketing his pulpit. And finally, we meet Grit. He's the unlikely leader of Deepwater and a newspaper reporter and a former student at New Jerusalem College. This Sunday morning, Grit is to attend two worship services, one to run sound for Pastor Lawson, the other to accompany Grace as she attends the service where her father preaches. Grit slapped his alarm and reached for his cargo shorts and a T-shirt. He might be headed for two sermons heavily seasoned with Old Testament legalism, but he didn't have to dress like it. He was hoping the Christian tattoos visible on his arms and legs would raise eyebrows. His only nod to convention was a quick shower, a shave of his face and head, and a bit of attention to his teeth. If he was going to offend, it wouldn't be with odor. Both of the congregations he would be joining expected solemn ritual, Sunday dress, and traditional behavior. Grit believed that guilt-induced church attendance and Sunday dress reflected a primitive need to appease the gods. But occasionally he wondered, am I claiming superior knowledge and insight? Am I just as misguided? Am I guilty of the sin of pride? And concluded, probably. He slipped out the front door for his Sunday paper, squinting against a beautiful but unwelcome sunrise. Back inside, he found his latest story, page 2, Metro section. Food poisonings. One has died and two remain hospitalized after 9 attendees at the Rainbow Unity Picnic Saturday, May 22nd, were diagnosed with salmonella poisoning. Mr. Trent S. Townsend, Sr., 84, died of complications at Bennettville Memorial Hospital Friday. 6 others remain under a doctor's care. 2 are being treated at Bennettville Memorial Hospital. The Reverend Bishop of Greater Bennettville First Methodist Episcopal Baptist Holiness Alpha and Omega International Tabernacle, and a 2-year-old whose name has not been released. Doctors report that Mr. Townsend Sr.'s advanced age contributed to his death. The illness seems to be confined to attendees who ate from a chocolate cherry cake, origin unknown. Both the toddler and Reverend Bishop Bishop are recovering and should be dismissed Monday. The Reverend Bishop's Commandment Sunday sermon, Thou Shalt Not Steal, will be replaced by a special prayer service on behalf of the food poisoning victims and their families. Not bad, Grid thought. Maybe next time I'll get a byline. Today was the Commandment Sunday Grit had mentioned in his story, the Memorial Day weekend observance instigated by Bennettville politicians to woo the vote of conservative Christians, ostensibly asking area preachers to pick a commandment and deliver an appropriate sermon. Fostered Christian unity and bolstered the resolve of city fathers to keep 2 ancient stone tablets on the grounds of the courthouse in spite of legal challenges. In practice, uncooperative One True Church preachers resisted the observance, calling it ecumenical. Unitarians decided it was too biblical, and the Pentecostals could not allow anyone but the Holy Spirit to determine what would be preached on any given Sunday. Episcopalians and Catholics had their own liturgy to follow, so the mainline Baptists, Methodists, and Lutherans picked up the flag and carried the day. Since then, most Bennettville churches had fallen into line, and a sermon on one or more of the Holy Ten was pretty much expected over Memorial Day, the tie-in being that American fighting men and women did not die in vain as long as the good citizens of Bennett County could observe the Ten Commandments, if only at the courthouse. It was rarely mentioned that the contested monument was donated by Colonel Jubal Lee Cornrow after a particularly splendid Confederate victory. Grit turned to the published sermon titles before reading the funnies. Commandments were assigned at the first of the year, giving Bennettville clergy plenty of time to twist the Old Testament admonitions past recognition by adding perennially favorite exclusionary church doctrines. Pastor Newell Post Lawson, for example, was preaching on, "Thou shalt not commit adultery. God is faithful to the Jews." Grit fully expected an eschatological tirade beginning in Genesis and ending in Revelation, explaining current historical events as the prelude to the end of the world. Brother Willis's title was "Thou Shalt Not Bear False Witness, Strange Worship," which left Grit with the distinct impression that he was in for another spirit-dampening lesson on why Christians should not use musical instruments or choirs in church services. Oh well, he thought, listening to see if I'm right might keep me awake.
So now we've met some of the main characters of nonprofit murders. Each of these preachers is assaulted in some way. Three end in death. One, Grit, survives. And it is the job of the police and Grit and Grace to find the perpetrator of these assaults. Now, I realize fully that these portrayals are all satirical characters, caricatures, if you will, of ministers. And being satirical, they're not all that flattering, but there is truth in them. So, as Becky indicated in her interview excerpt, do you see a reason for examination of the church from the outside? Is there a reason for the world to laugh at us? Maybe, maybe not. If so, are there things we need to consider changing? Not because of the world, but for the sake of the Bride of Christ and her reputation. I remember in the book of Acts that the church enjoyed the goodwill of all the people, Acts 2, verse 47. Some thoughts for you to consider today. Along the way in this book, we get to see some of the further workings in some of these congregations. We find the murderer, and we see what motivated that person. You're going to have to read or listen to the book to find the solution to these crimes. You'll find it at my website. Go to narrationbygeorge.com/books. At the top of the page, you will see our featured book for today's podcast. Just click on that icon to find more information. Well, that's our time for today for the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Remember, you can comment directly to me via email by clicking on the Contact Me link on my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com. Or you can communicate via Facebook, where I'm Narration by George, or on Twitter, where I'm at Narration by Geo. Don't forget to like the Facebook page or follow me on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Look forward to it. Remember, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with someone else.